It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll play some chess and listen to some hip-hop with the founders of Milwaukee's Hip Hop Chess Club. Now, Vikings from around the Midwest will journey to Green Bay this weekend for the region's largest Viking festival. UW-Green Bay's Viking House will be the new permanent location for the annual festival that celebrates Scandinavian history and culture. Heidi Sherman is an associate professor of history and director of the Viking House at UW-Green Bay, which is hosting the Midwest Viking Festival this Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Heidi, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having us on.
And Tim Jorgensen is director of the Viking Connection for the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota, one of the longtime coordinators of the Midwest Viking Festival. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim, give us a taste. When someone comes to a Midwest Viking Festival, what are they going to see?
We try to give a comprehensive experience of all the different Viking crafts and activities that we can find artists to provide from around the world.
And what kind of activities?
Well, you know, the public's favorite seems to be the battle demonstration. So we'll certainly have that with talks about the different types of weapons and shields and how the armor functions as well. But we broaden out into blacksmithing, metalwork, and woodwork, the textiles, the cooking demonstrations, even some more of the lesser common Viking Age arts and crafts. We always try to find somebody special to do that. So Thomas Riesholm's coming over. Well, he's here now already. Just got to Green Bay today from Denmark. He has a published book about beads of the Viking Age. So he'll be demonstrating glass bead making as a special international guest this year.
And Heidi, Vikings play a big role, I think, in popular culture. This is a deeper look, I think, than we might see on TV shows or comic books. So what are you hoping people take away in their understanding of the Vikings and Scandinavian culture more generally?
We're really trying to get away from the stereotype that all Vikings did was drink and fight and raid other people and each other. They did that, of course, but we're also interested in the tradition of handcraft in Scandinavia and Northern Europe. And having a Viking festival where people who study the Viking Age who are doing this crafts really attracts people. And it really emphasizes the possibilities of hands-on learning. And so we're really about daily life in medieval Scandinavia, but also where all the beautiful crafts that we see from Scandinavia, what their origins were, so if you go back 1,000 years in the Viking Age, you can see part of that process.
Tim, can you talk about the move from, I believe it was Fargo, North Dakota, to Green Bay, capturing the Viking Fest? What led to that move?
Yeah, we were held outside the Yumcomp Center in Moorhead, Minnesota for many years, and we're under the name Viking Village for so long. And we went through quite a bit in over a decade's time from being an independent Viking festival, just focusing on Vikings, to pairing up with the longer running Yumcomp Scandinavian Festival. And then when around the pandemic hit, we had some group discussions on what direction the County Historical Society wanted to take things. And it sounds like they agreed to focus more on the county's recent history, maybe in the last 100 or 200 years, as opposed to the last 1,000 years. I mean, of course, Vikings that we're dealing with for this event are a much older part of this, of the history of the people of this region, than those that were necessarily in Clay County, Minnesota. So the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota is going to be doing a lot more with its more current cultural events and history. It's often just called the Viking Museum there, and that's kind of understandable because of the Yumcomp ship and the Halperstead Stav Church, these two gigantic replica artifacts. But it's really the county's broader history needs to be in focus as well. So that's a change in a direction. But from my perspective as director of Viking Connection, one of our goals is to reach areas in the 5.5 state region that we work with where maybe Viking arts and crafts haven't had a presence, yet there's that underlying culture from the Scandinavian Americans that live in those regions. And Wisconsin is one of the states in the region we work with, and we haven't done much with Green Bay before. So here we are, and I love the grounds. The Viking House is the amount of space we have to work with, and the trees and everything is almost an exact copy of what we were working with at the MCOMP Center. So I think it's a perfect home.
And Heidi, I wanted to ask you about the Viking House for people who haven't checked it out. Tell us more about it, please.
Yeah, the house was actually built by a couple in central Wisconsin, and they wanted to, I mean, they'd been studying the Viking Age since the early 70s. And I used to take students out there for experiential learning weekends. And then when they moved, they donated the house and we raised the money to take the house apart and then rebuild it at the UW-Green Bay campus. Our campus is really experimental in a lot of ways and very much focused on experiential learning. So it was a great fit for us. And so we've been able to hold lots of events, and we fundraise and get external monies to hold these events. And so now we're so excited. So people can come and see this Viking House, which is actually based on, it's called a Grin Building, which is very familiar to Norwegian immigrants, because it was a type of structure. It's that was used, on farms and as a boat shed, but also 1,000 years ago in the Viking Age, it was also used as kind of like a townhouse. So we are really excited to have one on public land, and anybody is free to come and look at it. And of course, it's going to be open with the people who built the house showing it off at the Viking House on Friday and Saturday. Welcome to come for a tour.
I want to ask each of you briefly, what craft or demonstration are you most excited about seeing this weekend? Let's throw that to you, Tim, first.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we put a lot into getting Thomas Friesholm here from Denmark to demonstrate the glass bead making. And I think that'll certainly be a hit. He's going to be right near me and my woodcraft demonstration and display. I'll be making some toy swords out of wood. And those will be for kids. Anyone who wants one, stop by and I'll make sure you learn something along the way. But I should say we have a couple new faces. One of them I should mention is David Susek, who's going to be turning wood on a spring pole lathe. So wood bowls were a super common part of Viking Age daily life. And to see the process of how they were made is quite exciting using non-electric tools. So the spring pole lathe is a rope attached to a big springy pole operated by your foot. And it's just a fantastic thing to watch. So.
And Heidi, leave us with one thing you're particularly looking forward to.
I'm excited to have everybody come to the festival grounds. I want to say that the festival is sponsored by Wisconsin Humanities and also Viking Connection. We're very, very grateful that we're able to offer the experience free. So anybody is welcome to come. Just come have a good time. And there's absolutely no cost for this festival.
Thanks to both of our guests, Heidi Sherman, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Viking House at UW-Green Bay, and Tim Jorgensen, Director of the Viking Connection for the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota, organizers of the Midwest Viking Festival in Green Bay this Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Find a link to event info at wpr.org/centraltime. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about Wisconsin's roadside attractions.
Author Eric Dragne has been a keen observer of roadside attractions for years. He recently wrote the book, The Impossible Road Trip, that chronicles the most famous stops across the U.S. And believe it or not, Wisconsin is home to some of the quirkiest. Dragne takes us on a tour of the best roadside attractions across the state.
I was born in the shadow of the world's largest six-pack in La Crosse. My mom told me later that the nurses in the hospital there even gave her a beer to help bring the milk. Despite this, I realized I'd never conquer the world's largest six-pack, since those six silos hold enough beer to provide one person a six-pack a day for 3,351 years. Being born in Wisconsin, I just assumed these gigantic sculptures of everyday objects were destined to take their rightful place along the roadside to lure in visitors. Then I lived in Italy with all the supposedly tasteful statues and architecture. Later, when Italian friends came to visit me in the Midwest, I tried to show off our impressive architecture, the old churches, the Capitol. They'd respond, "You know, these are all just imitations of Italian buildings. You have seen St. Peter's in Rome, no?" With this in mind, I resolved to show my own kids what is truly American. We set out on the Wisconsin byways. We saw talking cows, rusty dinosaur statues, and too many mice eating cheese to count. A giant Bucky Badger in Burnham Wood is now half buried next to signs promising hot girls, cold beer. We got lost in the labyrinth of House on the Rock near Spring Green and discovered Dr. Evermore near Baraboo, who gave us a tour of his Forevertron, a Jules Verne-esque steampunk rocket ship before he blasted off into the heavens. A trip into the kitsch world of Wisconsin Dells never disappoints. Except when we discovered that Tommy Bartlett's robot world was brought into the 21st century with no more cheesy 1970s evil robot slaves, and Xanadu, the foam house of tomorrow, has been unceremoniously discarded. Perhaps all that hardened foam from Xanadu was repurposed as the new giant Roman Colosseum next to the upside-down White House. Why just look at some ancient Greek statues and sterile museums when you can drive a go-kart through the belly of a 6-story tall Trojan horse? The best of Wisconsin's roadside attractions come from a burning desire by an obsessed individual to create giant monuments to prove that I was here, like Fred Smith's Concrete Park in Phillips. Even better are those that are the result of a practical joke, such as Rhinelander's Hodag, an elaborate hoax based on the capture of a mythical monster with photos that ran on the front page of newspapers across the country. This is not normal behavior, thank God. And Wisconsin is full of it. Midwestern tourist bureaus drool over the idea of a lucrative roadside attraction, but the best sites are seldom devised by a committee in a boardroom. The creators are artistic visionaries, scorned as kooks and crazies, but are the very ones who give our towns character. Why raise statues to some self-important governor when you can create your own idol, like the 143-foot-long muskie in Hayward? Wouldn't you rather see that than some dusty old Roman statue that's missing its arms? Many of these fiberglass artifacts were born in Sparta at the Fast Company. They made Hayward's muskie and also a 55-foot half-man, half-peapod Jolly Green Giant in Minnesota, and a 38-foot-tall Holstein in North Dakota that is visible for 5 miles. My family and I visited their graveyard of discarded statues and seriously considered buying an enormous big boy for our front yard. What would the neighbors say? Instead, we put our ambitions aside, realizing we could never compete with the original grandeur of La Crosse's monument to beer.
Eric Dragne is the author of the new book, The Impossible Road Trip, about America's most famous roadside attractions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll check out Your Move Milwaukee, bringing young people together with hip-hop music and games of chess. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A club in Milwaukee combines two things you might not always put together in your mind, hip-hop and chess. Every week, members of the Hip Hop Chess Club meet to play the ancient game, listen to rap, and learn, in some cases, how to break dance or freestyle themselves. Raquel Aleman is the co-founder and executive director of Your Move Milwaukee, or Your Move NKE. Brandon Kitts is co-founder, project director, and music coordinator for Your Move MKE. Raquel and Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This is amazing.
Raquel, could you tell us the origin and the idea of this hip-hop chess club?
Sure. The idea originated with us all just having a really good, solid friendship and creating this club to work with young people, help them think ahead and make better moves in their future. And we love hip-hop, so of course, incorporating that, production, freestyle, breakdancing, and all of the arts of hip-hop. And it's grown into a pretty cool nonprofit. We've created a nonprofit out of it, and it's continues to grow into different programs as well.
Brandon, paint us a picture. A young person comes into a hip-hop chess club, I think on a Tuesday night. What do they see? What do they do?
Yeah, it's not something that fully can be expressed through words, but I will do my best. You walk into Miss Yesenia's creative studio space on the south side of Milwaukee, and you can learn how to play chess. And also while listening to hip hop beats, we have microphones set up. We have beat machines set up where you can beatbox, freestyle, sing, learn how to make beats. We try to offer all the elements of hip hop so kids can learn how to express themselves better. And it's a really chaotic, but like really creative and just amazing atmosphere. It's something that you definitely have to go to experience though, for sure.
Raquel, let's focus on the chess side of things for a minute. What does a young person, I guess, what do any of us get out of focusing in on chess? What kind of lessons can we take out of it?
So the game of chess is really, I guess it's a dope game because it helps you to really look at every angle, look at the whole board, as well as thinking before you make your moves, backing up your pieces. So we like to correlate that with everyday life for the young people. So, you know, while we're across the table from them, we're basically at the same level as them. It kind of puts us in the same eye level so they feel like they can relate to us. And we're able to organically mentor them and talk with them about their life situation and correlate that with chess.
Now, Brandon, you are a rapper yourself. I understand you've written a little something for us about the project. You want to share it with us?
Oh, yeah, sure. Definitely. I wrote this today, so I was super inspired by this, just the idea of doing this interview with you guys. So here it is. Yo, Hip Hop Chess Club been around for half a decade. The object of the chess game? It's checkmate, but long-term is thinking on a higher level. Cognition and strategy to make the mind work better. Play with different people, develop my own style, be part of community with friendships as profound. We're all kings and queens, it's definitely known now, with more than enough positive energy to go around. Analytical to creative skills, we came to build from the everyday stresses of staying in the mill, paying the bills. Ain't a game, this is real life. I feel like my tools are the bishops, rooks, and the knights at school. Not much more to it, this is your move, MKE. I implore you to explore new ways of being free. Believe you me, we could achieve whatever with chess, hip hop, and we together forever.
All right. We're talking to Brandon Kitts and Raquel Aleman from Your Move MKE, talking about the Hip Hop Chess Club there. In lyrical form there, we heard it from Brandon. Raquel, what has been the response so far? What are you hearing from young people in the area who get involved in this?
So the young people that come most often and are our regular kind of members or attendees, it's kind of hard to explain because we're more of a community. It's not really like a membership. Like, you don't fill out an application and come. We're really a community where it's more like a family. So the ones that have come and built a good relationship with us and the program, we hear from their parents that it helps them with their social skills. So we have some children that are homeschooled that don't really get to, you know, work with other children, even with COVID being around and the kids being secluded. It really helped them get involved with other children and other people in the community. And it also helps with like intergenerational programming. So being able to have those adults and children mingling together and having the young people play with the adults and learn skills and even the young people beating the adults most regularly. So it's just a really awesome time with the kids. And we hear that they absolutely love it. And it's just a safe space for them in an area that they don't have many safe spaces.
And Brandon, you're doing this in Milwaukee. Now, people around the state are listening. If somebody's thinking, yeah, we should have something like this, I want our own hip hop chess club, what would you suggest to them on getting something like this started?
Yeah, well, originally we got started, the first hip hop chess club was created in Rhode Island by this our mentor, Crook Rock, Eric Mercado. And he actually got us off the ground running with the hip hop chess club. And we're more than willing to help anyone get off the ground with stuff like this. Like, just because we need each other, man. We really do need each other to build off and, you know, spread knowledge and stuff. So you can hit any of us up. You can check our Facebook page, or you can even go to our website, which is yourmovemke.org. You can contact us through that way. But yeah, I would definitely recommend, yeah, this should be in every city in America, if not the world. It's definitely a really cool idea, really awesome. It's a rewarding to be a part of too, you know, it's amazing.
And Raquel, I was so wondering, what is the next move for Your Move MKE? What are your hopes for the future of this project?
Sure. So as Brandon said, we started off as a club and a program. Hip Hop Chess Club. And since February 2020, we created Your Move MKE, which is actually a nonprofit. So we do have other programs as well. We have a youth-based open mic. We're hoping to open an urban trade skills program soon to help young people transition into trade skills and the union. And then we also do breakdancing to help with physical and emotional health. So everything that we do correlates basically higher level thinking and mental health or trauma healing. And we correlate it with hip hop. And our goal is to have a building and be able to offer all types of programming and creating different ways to bring that forward. So financial literacy, but a creative way to teach our kids. The old ways aren't working, so we need to do something new.
Now, Brandon, at a certain age, I might think, well, I'm not good at chess and I'm not good at rap. Well, that's still true. I'm not good at rapping. Make a case that a kid with that lack of skills should still come in and check it out.
Because whatever you do, you know, you got to get your reps in. You got to, everyone starts at level one. Everyone begins at the beginning. I was terrible at chess. I was terrible at rapping. Now I'm okay at chess and I'm pretty good at rapping. So you just got to do it. You just got to go for it. And you're part of a community now, positive energy. And yeah, we build each other up. That's really what it is.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Raquel Alamon, co-founder and executive director of Your Move MKE, and Brandon Kitts, also co-founder, project director, and music coordinator for Your Move MKE. They talked to us about the Hip Hop Chess Club. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can be challenging to find the right housing as we age or as our family members get older, and a housing shortage is making it more difficult in many communities. We'll check out some possible solutions, and you could share your stories. And some states around the country are ending or changing their cash bail systems for people accused of crimes. What happens next? We'll check out the latest research and find out what cash bail is supposed to accomplish in the first place. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then midterm candidates in Wisconsin and around the country are agreeing to fewer debates this time around or opting out of them altogether. We'll find out why and what debates mean to voters. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report tracks the impact of gerrymandered district lines around the country and what happens when independent commissions draw the lines instead of elected officials. We'll get the details, and you can join in with your thoughts and questions. First, candidates in some of this year's midterm races around the country are agreeing to fewer debates than usual or opting out of them altogether. That's true in Wisconsin, too, with a general election debate season that's shaping up to be slower than usual. Republican challenger Tim Michaels and Democratic Governor Tony Evers recently announced they'll hold one debate before Election Day in November. In the U.S. Senate race so far, Republican Senator Ron Johnson has accepted three invitations. His Democratic challenger, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, so far has only accepted one. Our next guest says we lose something when candidates cut back on debates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a voter, as a citizen, does this matter to you? Do you want to see candidates debate more? Candidates including Wisconsin's race for governor or U.S. Senate, for example, are debates valuable to you as a voter? What would you change about the way we do debates with political candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Diana Carlin is Professor Emerita of Communications at St. Louis University. She's studied political debates for over four decades and is the author of multiple books on the topic, including the 1992 Presidential Debates in Focus. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
We're seeing reports from all over the country where it seems like, you know, debates aren't going to be non-existent, but they are fewer and further between than usual. What is your reaction as we get closer to Election Day?
Well, I'm disappointed. You know, as a voter, I want to hear the debates, and I think the public deserves to have them. I've always viewed the debates as a job interview, and it's just like asking people to hire you without going through the interview.
What do you think is driving candidates to maybe be more reluctant to debate?
All of the reasons why they are good are probably the reasons. They reach more people in an unfiltered way. They get into issues in more depth than a 30-second spot or a piece of direct mail or a robocall. You can get nailed by your opponent or by a question. They come with a high amount of risk. And we have a lot of very, very close races around the country at many levels, and especially incumbents. Incumbents are always reluctant to debate. And I know I live in Kansas now, and our incumbent Republican senator is refusing to debate the challenger. And there are fewer debates on the other levels, too. So it is across the country, as your introduction said. But the high risk, the fact that if you do make a mistake, it gets played over and over. And with social media, some of this gets retweeted. All of those are reasons why I think people are refusing to do it.
Now, if I'm a candidate in 2022, and I'm not for good reason, but if I am, I have a lot of ways to get, use the word unfiltered, I have a lot of ways to get filtered messages out to people. There's social media, as you mentioned. There's the old broadcast ads, YouTube ads, streaming ads, whatever. There are probably friendly media sources I know I can go to and say what I want to say. How do we overcome, I guess, the incentive structure to go to these controlled forms of outreach as opposed to these more risky forms of outreach for a candidate?
I think there are some ways to get around it so that people are more encouraged to debate. I mean, this is part of the thing, is how the debates are done often is what causes candidates to not want to participate. So the negotiation part is very important, to where people think it's fair. There aren't going to be the gotcha kinds of questions. You know, one of the reasons that the Commission on Presidential Debates went to a single moderator was that it reduced the risk for people to try to show off. If you had three people up there on the stage or four, think about the primary debates. They all want to be the one to ask the gotcha questions. And so they often don't concentrate on major issues. But if you, for instance, have a single moderator, you tell them these are the four issues we're going to talk about, and they have somebody who they really trust, that you're going to have questions from the audience, you know, whatever. If it's outlined and it looks like it has less risk, you might get people to participate more.
In our current political climate, it seems like it's hard to get two parties or two candidates to agree on one person that they're going to agree is fair and non-biased. Do you see that as part of the challenge?
It is part of the challenge. And once again, you can see that with the presidential debates. Everybody has some complaint about whomever they select. Jim Lehrer was considered really the poster child for how to do this in a way that was even-handed. And that's why he did it and was the only one we had for years and years and years. And as soon as people thought that he had maybe stepped over that line a little bit, then there were the complaints, and you began seeing a different moderator for each of the debates. But, you know, I've actually negotiated some of these in the past and have advised groups that are putting them on locally or in the state. And I think you can find people who are considered honest brokers. And that's, you know, the challenge to the sponsoring agency or the network to do that. But it's, you know, I think you have a greater chance of having a debate if you have an open seat or if you have a vulnerable incumbent who feels like they have to debate to show that they, you know, what they've done, they have a better chance of doing that. They can directly answer what the opponent is saying. So the incumbency factor also filters in as well as whether it's a vulnerable candidate or not.
Talking to Diana Carlin from St. Louis University, expert on political debates over the last bunch of decades, looking at an apparent decline in the number of debates happening in big races in this year's midterm election. Often the number is one or sometimes zero. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see value in getting candidates for high-profile offices in particular up in front of the cameras at the same time, the same venue, debating one way or another the big issues? Do you think it's a waste of time? Do you worry about how debates are done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Diana, we heard from Paul on Facebook who says debates can be entertaining, but quoting here, by and large, there doesn't seem to be anyone changing who they're voting for based on debates. And Paul goes on, it's just about motivating marginal and occasional voters and clips for political advertising. So Paul not seeing a lot of value, I guess, Diana.
Well, a lot of people say that, but one of the points I always make when they say it doesn't change minds is that part of what motivates people to vote is if they have confidence in the person for whom they're voting. And what my research over all these years has shown, and that of others, is that it's just as important to solidify a vote, because then you're more motivated to actually vote. You see the person and you compare it to the person on the same stage. And then it's like, yeah, I really do need to go out and vote. Oftentimes it is those margins. Look at how many close races we have. And we've certainly had debates that have turned the tide. I can remember one, it was in one of my very first years of being eligible to vote, living in the state of Kansas. We had, open seat, and one of the candidates was not very well known. The other one was incredibly well known and was way ahead in the polls. And they had a couple televised debates. This was back when there were far fewer networks, but the newspapers carried it. It completely flipped that race. And that was because suddenly people saw the vulnerabilities of this person who'd just been in the news a lot. And the lesser known candidate suddenly is like, this is the voice of reason. And so it completely changed the dynamic of the race. And that's one of the things where I think the media is important. You know, there have been times when the media has had an empty chair. There have been several empty chair debates. In 1980, Jimmy Carter refused to show up for a three-way debate, and they had a two-way debate. And he got beat up by two people and wasn't there to defend himself with Reagan and John Anderson. But, you know, everything that I have heard, both at, you know, looking at state level and especially at national level, is that even if you change in a close race or get an undecided voter to decide, the debate can make a difference. And if it motivates people to go out and vote, especially in a lackluster campaign where people aren't too excited, yeah, I'm going to probably vote for this person, but this motivates them to do it, they can make a difference.
And Brad on Facebook says, let's have true debate where there is one topic resolved and make the candidates stick to that topic. Brad says they might even have to do some work to defend their position. And yeah, Diana, I think most of the debates I could think of are we're covering as many topics as we can fit in. What do you think of that idea, whether it's a formal debate structure, sticking with one topic for debates?
I like it. And in fact, it's been something that I have proposed. I think one of the best debates ever was one in 1948, a radio debate in a primary, which changed the outcome of the Republican primary, the Dewey-Stassen debate. And they had one topic, and that was that communism should be outlawed, but it was broadcast nationwide. Up to that point, Stassen was clearly winning the Republican nomination, and it totally flipped that one. And Thomas Dewey, you know, became the nominee, and of course, according to some paper, you know, beat Truman. But it is something that I have recommended. And once again, it's something that at the presidential level has changed, where it used to be a free for all, but now they announce ahead of time that there will be like four major topics. And I agree with that comment that we need fewer topics in more depth. But then, of course, you have to have more than one debate in order to give people the information on what might be of greater interest to them.
We're talking to Diana Carlin, Professor Emerita of Communications at St. Louis University. She studied political debates over the decades, and we're talking to her about a lack of political debates in a lot of this year's midterms, ranging in many cases from zero to one debate, even in high-profile races. What we lose, she says, when candidates don't debate and debate often. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Do you want to see more debates? Do you see a value in them? How should they work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the role of political debates in elections, and this year's elections in particular, and why a lot of candidates are doing fewer debates, in some cases zero debates, during this year's midterms. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own ideas to make candidate debates work better. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just wondered if the guest could comment on this being a sign of our gradual approach to authoritarianism and belief in a kind of an idolatry toward one particular personality.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Diana, do you see a lack of debate as, I guess, a step away from democracy in some form?
Yeah, I think it is. I've spent a lot of time in new democracies over the years, going in on non-governmental organizations or with the State Department to take political debates into those democracies because they saw them as a starting point, that you suddenly now are being transparent and people can look side by side and make the comparisons themselves based on what the two candidates or in these other countries, multiple candidates have said. And if we don't have that, then we have lost some of the transparency. We have lost the opportunity for ourselves to compare what's being said, as opposed to what parts of it were being fed by the media or by the candidates themselves. And I just think in an open society, in a democratic society, that debate is a fundamental part of what that is. And by not having them, I agree, we are losing something.
Thanks for that call. Let's go next to Joe in Milwaukee. Joe, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I've been kind of following the flow here. I agree with the last several callers. We really need to have mono subject debates, you know, one subject examined thoroughly. That's going to force the issue of letting the American people know just how informed their candidates are. And kind of put them on the spot, as it were. I mean, I hate putting people on the spot, but in this day and age, you know, when facts don't actually matter anymore to a large percentage of the population, I think it's important, one, just to raise some of these issues and let people see that there are other perspectives on these issues other than what they get from Facebook and Tinder. And also, you know, it forces the issue of showing what the candidate as an individual actually knows about any given subject. And you could have a series of these. I mean, I would start with democracy in America and the rule of law and kind of go from there. I mean, you could have all kinds of different subjects. You could talk about any of the different amendments to the Constitution and, you know, get them talking about each one and what it means. I think it's a terrific idea, and I think it's an idea that we need now more than ever.
Joe, thanks for the call. Diana, no major argument from you, I'm guessing?
No, I would agree. And if you stop and think about whether it's a Senate race, a House race, a governor's race, you know, attorney general, whatever, it really does come down to two or three top issues. And polling data helps us know what's on the public's mind and what's been in the news. And so it's not that difficult to narrow this down to two or three topics. You know, the problem, I agree with the caller, it would be nice to have a series of two or three debates that get at the top topics. It's hard to get the candidates to even agree to one. But even if you could have a debate that's centered on the top two issues that, you know, the public polling is showing are on people's minds, because those often relate to other issues. So if, you know, one of it is the economy, and they're looking at jobs. Well, when you're talking about jobs, then you're also talking about what that impact is going to be on the education system. So it allows them to show their breadth of knowledge. I agree with the caller completely that we need some focus, and a debate can do that and can get you the depth.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Joan with us in Sauk City. Joan, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joan?
Well, I do think the debates are important.
it shows the depth of knowledge of the candidates on the issues that are of interest to us. It also shows their personality and their respondents to something that may irritate them in some ways, but, you know, otherwise all we get is what they want to tell us on the news and in what we read and get through our mail, instead of actually seeing their opinions on topics that they may not have sent out to us through their ads.
Joan, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Diana, again, this the opportunity to see those unfiltered candidates. Joan likes that.
Yes, and Joan, I think you're right on target. These are individuals who want to be public officials. They're going to be subjected to questions they don't like from the media if they're elected. They have it on the campaign trail. And to shy away from facing the voters who are hiring them, it really says something, too, about the character. And I know candidates who want debates often play up that point. You know, historically, there's a great example of it. Back in 1992, President George H.W. Bush hated debates, and he thought he could negotiate his way out of the three debates that were being proposed. So he kept dragging out the negotiations, and the first debate date came along, and he wasn't there, and Clinton had a big rally, and then Perot got in, and then they finally got the debates. But before Bush finally agreed to go back to the negotiating table, there was a guy who was following him around in a chicken suit. Older people will remember this one, with a sign that said, "Chicken George won't debate." And that got incredible attention. Comments were made about it. Why is he afraid to get on a stage? And that helped get him back to the negotiating table. So candidates who want to debate and aren't have some opportunities to really comment on their opponent and their opponent's unwillingness. And why are they afraid to face the people and answer questions? So I think whatever the public can do, whatever the media can do, again, to point out that people are sort of hiding from what some of us consider, and your callers have, an obligation to present their side and be compared directly with their opponent.
Thanks for the call, Joan. Faith joins us next in Madison. Faith, hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for this topic and the program. I guess I have a couple questions. One is, you know, I'm wondering who is in charge of making the decisions about what ultimately happens in a debate, and why can't we expect more of people running for office? I mean, even entry-level jobs have higher requirements, it seems, in many cases, for what people need to go through in order to be considered for a position, and these are very high-level positions. So I don't understand why we can't expect more of the people who are running and insist that they, you know, if they're not going to participate in a debate, then they're not going to run.
Faith, thanks for the call. Diana, to Faith's first point, who tends to be the outfit, the organization setting up these debates in the first place?
Well, that sort of depends on where you are. Some of them are media outlets. So if they're televised in a studio, it would be one of the networks, possibly Public Broadcasting has often done those. Some of the time, the League of Women Voters puts them on. They were the first ones to ever put on debates, and they were doing it right after they were formed, after the 19th Amendment in 2020. So they've been in that business a long time. Some of the time, it's other types of organizations that do it. So it's a variety, and they are the ones who try to get the candidates' staffs together and negotiate something that they can both live with. State fairs often have debates. We just had a debate at the Kansas State Fair a couple weeks ago with our gubernatorial candidates. The Senate debate did not happen. So, you know, in various states and cities and even in the country, in the U.S., the Commission on Presidential Debates has been around since the 88 election, and they're the ones who do the general election debates. The primary debates are all done by the networks. And if you notice the difference between the primary debates for president and the general election, the primary debates have advertising. These are money makers for them, and that's part of why they aren't useful, like one of our early callers said, because they're all out there for the gotcha questions and the ratings. The general election debates are paid for privately. They're all done through a 501, a nonprofit, and it's all money that's been contributed, and there are no ads. So they are not commercials. They are not a moneymaker for anyone.
Diana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, you are very welcome.
That's Diana Carlin, debate expert at St. Louis University, looking at a decline in the number of political debates apparently this year around the country. Coming up, a look at gerrymandering and competitive congressional seats. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.